So I was saying to a couple of students, I felt really bad on Monday. I normally remember to put up a don't forget to vote thing as a slide because it's important. Whoever you vote for, you get out and vote. And I actually went home to my wife and said, I can't believe it. I forgot to put up the thing. I'm going to blame it on her. She made me go out and vote early. Normally I vote on the day, so I'm going to blame her. But how many of you guys voted? Oh, yay, you. How many of you guys meant to vote but didn't get around to it or forgot? It happens, right? So, all right. So hopefully you participated in the democratic process, however the vote comes out. All right. So lecture 21, November 9th, post-election. Lecture notes, page 189. Repetitive, but it doesn't hurt to remind you about study abroad over spring break. Doesn't hurt to remind you about the digital marketing course for spring. So mini test 9 closed last week, 10 closes on the regular schedule, 10 is the end of the material for midterm 2, which opens on the schedule on Saturday. Pack back enhanced learning extra credit number 7, closed tonight, regular schedule, 10 opens tomorrow, regular schedule. Research extra credit number 2, how many folks have done that to help out our researchers? So yeah, not that many. So help yourself, help our researchers, Webbies, you can jump in too. And go to the extra credit module or check the email I sent you and participate in the survey. Help our researcher out. We know that winter and midterm 2 are both coming. Any questions on midterm 2? We've been over this a lot. Questions on it? What it's covering, how it works, what we're doing, blah, blah, blah. Yo! Do you have to do it? Absolutely not. You do not have to do anything you do not want to do in this course. This is entirely whatever you want to do. As I say at the beginning of the course, you earn the grade that you get, but that's between you and you, right? Or, as I mentioned at the beginning of the course, if your parents are billionaires, see me on the side. Other than that, no, you'd have to do anywhere. I don't care. We know the new rules. So, how many folks either have family or friends whatever, at Lordstown, working at Lordstown? Anybody? Just one person. Wow, I thought this might be of interest. How many all from that neck of the woods? Nobody. Oh, one guy. All right, well then I'll just skip over this. So, Lordstown, which is near us here in Ohio, aims to boost electronic vehicle production with Foxconn Investment, and it's seeking also a new automaker partner. Struggling electric startup Lordstown Motors still plans to deliver the first examples of its endurance pickup truck, up there in the upper right, before the end of the year. They said on Tuesday, a day after it announced a new investment from Taiwanese contract manufacturer Foxconn. So we're seeing something we've talked about already, new product marketing. Also, from especially Foxconn's viewpoint, foreign investment in another country, this is global marketing from their perspective. Lordstown said that it's now building endurance at a very slow rate while it works to build out its assembly line and awaits final regulatory approval to sell the trucks. I guess I should have added legal, regulatory, and governmental influence on business and marketing there. The company now expects to build about 30 pickup trucks for sale by the end of the year and to complete the remainder of the first batch of 500 trucks by the end of June next year. So this would be a beginning of a pretty long introductory stage in a product life cycle. Seems like they're taking a while to get out of the gate. Lordstown said in late September that it hoped to build 50 trucks by year end, but to date it's only completed 12 trucks. So all of us thinking about operation management and manufacturing stuff, there's some operational issues with new products. The new Foxconn investment of $170 million will help address the lack of capital that has hindered Lordstown's efforts to get the endurance into production. That's all you finance guys thinking about how you help marketing do what he needs to do, get us some money. Lordstown previously told investors that its first batch of endurance pickups will be limited to a maximum of 500 because the cost of building a pickup is currently material higher than the company's expected selling price, which is reported to be starting at $65,000. So there's price in the mix, and the reminder of a topic we're about to hit. Profit is equal to revenue minus expenses, and if your expenses are way, way higher than you thought, your profit's going to go down. So we have that cooking. Additional investments in manufacturing tooling would bring the cost down, but CEO Edward Hightower has deferred those investments to preserve cash. Lordstown is actively seeking an automaker partner to help scale up production of the Endurance. So a bit about business partnerships. So we'll see if this new EV company in our area makes it or not over time, but I thought that was an interesting local story. We all know Anheuser-Busch, InBev, it's buying a major league pickleball team. How many people know pickleball? Who doesn't know pickleball? Me too, until recently. How many people play pickleball? So the way you play it, apparently, is very leisurely, and you're bouncing a ball around. It's sort of a combination of table tennis and wiffle ball and a tennis, whatever. And then who's seen this stuff on TV, the professional pickleball players? Have you seen it? It's like killer ball, man. They're going to hurt each other. Quite a difference between what you see out on the back lawn. So anyhow, Anheuser-Busch has been synonymous with big-time sports for decades, whether it's paying the most to be the Super Bowl's largest advertiser with commercials featuring the Clydesdale and Dalmatians, or owning Major League Baseball's St. Louis Cardinals. The Brewers' Budweiser and Bud Light brands are ubiquitous in the sports world. So we're seeing a bit of sports marketing here, right? Leave it to AB InBev to invest in the country's fastest-growing sport, pickleball. AB InBev announced it's buying a Major League pickleball franchise starting with the 2023 season. The deal gets the Brewer back into the sports team ownership business. It ran the Cardinals from 53 to 95. We have already seen world-class individuals invest in teams and partnerships, and we share in their belief and excitement for the future success of this pickleball league stuff and the sport, said Matt Davis, head of U.S. Sports Marketing and Partnership at AB InBev, in a statement. We have some sports management majors. Anybody here today? Sports management? Webbies? Somebody out there? You? Okay. The agreement gives AB InBev control over one of MLP's new expansion teams. The Brewer will call the shots on everything from player drafts to team sponsors. Anheuser-Busch would have a unique ability in understanding the needs of fans, bringing them closer to the sport and the brands they love. I can't wait to see how this partnership will elevate both the Major League Pickleball sport, both the league and the sport of pickleball in the years to come, said the founder, Steve Kuhn. So there's a marketing partnership at work in a new burgeoning era. We'll have to wait for the pickleball world championships. Finally, anybody out in New York or knows Magnolia Bakery for any reason? Magnolia Bakery? None of these things are resonant. You don't know any of this stuff. I should just scrap it all. Well, Magnolia Bakery, if you're into the confectionery arts or in New York, is really a big deal. So Magnolia Bakery ships its first ever TV spot to homes nationwide. Magnolia Bakery has become a New York icon. Established in 96, the shop has exceeded local popularity to become a nationally recognized city marketer, almost as identifiable as Central Park or Broadway, but not here in Ohio, I guess. So there's their brand image. Nationwide shipping has done its part to spread the love, allowing Magnolia's fans from all over the country to enjoy its famous banana pudding, cupcakes, and more without having to trek all the way to the Big Apple, a fact that underscores the brand's first ever nationwide TV spot titled The New Yorkers Are Coming, which debuted yesterday. So we're building awareness. Here is a version of their ad.
Without that overlay. No snacks?
We are the snacks pudding.
Look, they rolled out the red carpet for us.
Wow. Broadway.
This isn't even New York.
Wow. Off-Broadway. Ship desserts like us nationwide.
So, presumably building awareness with that little advertisement. The 15-cent spot features animated versions of Magnolia's fame treats arriving to a home kitchen away from New York. Despite being rather far off Broadway, as one odd cookie quips, the snacks still feel as though they have arrived. So there's their ad theme. Though it's been shipping its cupcakes since 2012 and banana pudding since 2017, Magnolia's delivery services saw a surge during the pandemic. So one more time, the continuing impact of the pandemic on consumers and marketing. Now, even as bakeries are back and operational, the brand continues to lean into the potential of its shipping offerings, especially with the holidays just around the corner. So this is planning your ad timing. Maybe people would like to send confectionery love over the holidays. We focus the message to highlight our nationwide delivering during peak gifting demand to new consumers outside of our home markets, said Magnolia's chief marketing officer, Eddie Rivas. So we see their growth strategy, a market development strategy, that is to say existing products to new markets. A core driver of the commercial was staying true to our New York City heritage and DNA, where the brand first started on a quaint corner in the West Village. Using the medium of TV allowed us to create opportunities, celebrate all the personalities and desserts of our New York roots, and introduce those elements to new consumers outside of our home market. So again, building brand image outside the market, building awareness. The commercial will stream across platforms like Hulu, Paramount Plus, YouTube, NBC Universal, FX, Hallmark, Bravo, ABC, CBS, and more through the end of the year. So there's their media channel selection, which is almost everything. All right, so Magnolia Bakery, maybe it'll be a cupcake in your future. Picking up with pricing, page 189 of the lecture notes, and not 38, that's for sure. Whatever it is in the textbook, typo there. Talking most recently about the, from our perspective, second P of the marketing mix, that is the idea of price. And I actually had this set. How did it go away? We did that. We did that. That's where we left off. All right, so we ended up with the idea of the, quote, price for tuition at KSU. What we're looking at, the principle we're working on, is that the price is equal to the list price minus any incentives and allowances plus any extra fees, and we just applied it to the example of Kent State. But it applies across virtually all marketing institutions. So price is an indicator of value. You do not pay more money for something than it's worth to you. Or if you do, you only do it the first time. You don't go back and do it again. So price is an indicator of value to the consumer. It takes on different meanings. So value can be seen as the ratio of the perceived benefits, what am I getting out of this purchase, to the price itself. So we have a little formula, value is equal to perceived benefits divided by price. How many folks like pizza? Pizza, okay. So you know you can order a small pizza at a particular price point. Then you can order a large one. Do they double the price? They don't typically double the price. It's a value deal for you. So in this example, a small 10-inch pizza is $9.19. A large 16-inch pizza is only $12.59. And if you apply your geometry, you'll realize you're getting 2.5 times the pie at less than twice the price. Holy mackerel, a value for me. Let's get the large. It's not relatively as expensive. It's a good value. So there we have a good value in pizza and in other areas as well. And so price cannot exceed the perceived value of what it is you're selling. And as I say, maybe you can mess with the consumer once and give them less than they're expecting, but they aren't coming back to you if they're sane. So price cannot exceed the perceived values of the attributes that are being offered by your product. One strategy, taking this into account and recognizing this, is called value pricing. Here, we are going to simultaneously increase product and service benefits, the things that consumers value, while we either keep our price steady or decrease our price. That's a cool thing if you can make it happen. So, for example, when it was new, McDonald's new list of burgers and other items priced at $1, $2, and $3 is aimed at creating value for customers. But it looks like the real value is to the fast food giant's bottom line. The idea was that cheap tiered pricing, $1, $2, $3, would put more food and drinks onto consumers' buying list. But it also held out the hope that customers might gravitate to some of the more profitable and higher priced items. In fact, it worked out pretty well. Consumers go in, they look at, hey, $1, $2, $3, that's a deal. I'm going to do that. Then they go ahead and end up purchasing more items than people who do not order from the value menu. I don't know if we're going to get into an ethical debate. Is that sneaky? Is that ethical? Or is it on the consumer? You could spend $1 or $2, or you could spend $2 times 3, 4, 5, 6 times that you wouldn't have done before. I'm not sure who we blame on that. But they're trying to offer you a deal and don't mind that you buy more than those that don't buy from the special menu. So that's the idea of value pricing. We've already alluded to the profit equation, which certainly all accountants know, and the rest of us should know as well. So profit is equal to total revenue minus total cost. I think I've been calling it expense. And what is total revenue equal to? Well, whatever your price is, the unit price, times the number of those things that you sell. That's revenue. And what's total cost? It's made up of two components, fixed cost plus variable cost. If you're in business, it's good to know these things. It's not clear to me that all business people know these things, because sometimes they go out of business because they can't get their expenses under control relative to their revenue. They're losing money. It's basic. All right, so here we're going to look at the six steps in setting price from a marketing viewpoint. And what we would start with is some objectives and some constraints. Pricing objectives specify the role of price in your marketing and strategic plans. So, for example, one approach to pricing might be to manage for long-run profits. You're not trying to make a killing in the market today. You're going to price such that you're in it for the long run, you're making a little bit of profit every time, and over the long run, you've got profitability, is one approach. So you're not worried about getting the most profit you can today. Or, given your situation, it might make more sense to manage for current profit. So maybe what you're trying to do in this quarter is boost up your profitability so that analysts look at you and say, hey, they're doing really well. Let's boost their stock market, their stock value, right? Could be a strategy for you. Or maybe you're thinking about your investors. Investors have a lot of choices where to put their money. One of the possibilities is to put their money in you. But they can earn a return on investment elsewhere. So maybe what you're thinking about is return on investment. In this case, you're shooting to assure your investors it's a good investment versus the other places they could put their money. Different approaches to what you're doing with your pricing. Or you might not focus on the idea of profit, but on the idea of sales. You might feel that you're going to price to get the biggest number of sales dollars that you can. Or you want to be number one or number two in market share, and one way to get there, arguably, is through price, and you're going to use pricing to be number one or number two. Or you might want to raise up unit volume. We probably said before, but I'll say again, every time you double production on a production line, your unit costs should decline by 10% or more. So our good friends at Lordstown, if they can get their production line going, can get those costs down. Because economies of scale, you can buy in larger quantities all of the pieces and parts you need. Because of the learning curve, there's less mistakes, there's less errors, there's less damaged merchandise going out the door that has to be fixed. So you might say, I really got to get these unit costs down. I'm going to price to get more and more unit volume going. Or there are other objectives. Survival. We know in this most recent COVID period, some companies were just doing what they could to survive till the darn thing passed, right? So they just priced to get whatever they could to keep the doors open. Or social responsibility, right? It's a goal for, I should say, some companies in the BLM COVID-19 era, but beyond that, sustainability, green, social responsibility can be another element in your pricing. So we would say, look, marketer, you don't have to price everything to get the maximum possible profit out of it. You may have other mission, including social responsibility, being green, helping people, helping the environment, right? And so you might price a little differently such that you aren't making the biggest profit. You have other things in mind. On the other hand, as a business, you have some constraints, obviously. You can't just price it anything. So these are the factors that limit the range of prices that you might set. We know from our microecon course that there is a relationship between price and demand, but we also know that demand itself varies depending on consumer factors, the economy, etc. So one thing that constrains us is overall demand for the product class itself. So what is the current demand for cars, if we're in that market? Would be a limiting factor. But then we can be a little more specific. So what about the type of car we're selling? Cars may be going strong, but maybe everybody's buying SUVs. They aren't buying sports cars, our market, or the other way around. So we're limited by the demand of the product, not just the product class. And then, of course, the brand itself. What's the current demand for the Bugatti Chiron or the Ford Focus? So we're limited by that underlying demand that we have to be aware of, we have to track, an economic factor that would be important to us. Also, our price is constrained by the newness of a product. Anybody recall all the way back to the conversation about product life cycle when you have a unique, new, innovative product? Do you tend to price higher or lower? Are you able to price higher or lower? You're able to price higher, right? People really want that. It's new. You're the only one selling it. What about into the maturity and decline stage of the product life cycle? Then you're going to be down, down, down. You're constrained by the newness of the product. Beanie Babies are not new. And what used to sell for really big bucks in the old days, you can now get for, I don't know, 99 cents. That thing was not 99 cents when it first came out, but we're too far down the product life cycle for us to charge a higher price. Oh, versus, I don't know if that was a click or not, but versus something like the Samsung Crystal Ultra High. Yeah, so, it looks like that price manager. Is that the Ultra High one? Wow, I want to buy three of those. All right, so newer stuff, maybe that's not a good example. Hold on, now I'm interested in what I have out here. How about the 8K? What's it going for? Give me a second here to catch up with myself. There's a 98-inch 8K. It's a secret. How much is it? Where is it? Oh, there we go. Now we're talking something. $9,999, whatever that is. So they vary, depending on the product life cycle. Also, you're a company. Are you carrying one product? Do you have a whole set of product lines you have to think about? That's going to constrain what you can do. For example, you sell Yoplait. You have Yoplait Original. You have Yoplait Light. You have Yoplait Simplet. You have Yoplait Greek Yogurt. How are you going to price that? Are you going to price it all at the same level? I guess you could. It would keep things simple. But I presume you came up with different sub-brands, different types, because you feel there are different segments out there, different population that would pay different amounts of money for these things. Also, by the way, I assume there's cost differences in those as well. So you can see the basic line of Yoplait Original, 25 delicious flavors. By the way, I don't know, do all those flavors cost the same in terms of cost? I don't know that they do, but they probably don't. But you don't want to run 25 different price points on your basic line, do you? So they put those all out at 79 cents for a 6-ounce cup. The light, 66 cents, since it's light, for a single serving cup. Yoplait Simplet, suggested retail price of 90 cents per single serving cup, including our various flavors. And then the top of the line, the Yoplait Greek, $1.29 per single serving cup. I have different product lines. They're there for a reason. I believe there are different segments who will value these products differently and pay different amounts for them. Yeah? So that's a constraint as well. Obviously, we are constrained by the cost of producing and marketing the product. Our good friends over at Lordstown can't very well be selling their car for $45,000. If they aren't making money at $60,000, it's a problem. And then, interestingly, something that wouldn't leap to mind, but we're also constrained by the cost of changing prices and how long those prices apply. Let's take a moment and mull over that. Question coming. How can changing my prices cost me money? Why is making price changes bring expense with it? Yeah. Plus, I do have to market that price change, not just check on it, but I got to market it. So if I'm using brochures, if I'm using catalogs, I got to re-ramp all those things with the new price points to get it out to market it to those consumers. Even the website, depending how many products I have, it's going to cost some time and money to get those changes done to market it out there. Right? And then what if I'm changing prices all the time? Man, you better not be trying to do that with catalogs, because catalogs are there for a quarter or whatever. You can't do it. So what's it going to cost you to make just the price change itself? Never mind confusing the consumer. All right? So we have to think about that stuff as well as being constraints. You also have to take into account what sort of market you're in. You don't have the same amount of pricing freedom in all types of markets. What's our example of pure competition? Who remembers pure competition from micro, from our early discussion? What's an example of pure competition? Everybody's marketing the same commodity product. What's an example there? Yeah. Sugar, wheat, rye, right? What's your favorite brand of rye? And not that kind, the grain kind. I don't have a, it's okay, so you don't have a lot of pricing ability there. In those sorts of situations, it's driven by the market. Monopolistic competition, we talked about before, where you have the ability to differentiate your brands from other people and price differently based on that differentiation. Oligopoly, just a few big companies. Again, how many video game companies are there? There's only a few, right? So there's a few big companies that are paying attention to each other in their pricing. Monopoly, of course, is a pure monopoly, and they get to set the price unless they're regulated or whatever they want. So we do have to be aware of, A, how much freedom do we have given the type of competitive market we're in, and B, what our competitor prices are being set at. So in pure competition, many sellers follow the market price for identical commodity products like grain. There's almost no price competition. The market sets the price for the commodity out there. Extended product differentiation, none. Essentially, wheat is wheat is wheat. And how much advertising do you use? Not too much. Why? Because all you're going to do is let people know that you're available to be purchased. It's not that your product is different. Monopolistic competition, things like toilet paper and toothpaste. Many sellers compete on non-price factors, differentiation. So there is some price competition over a range of prices. There's some differentiation of products from competitors. So Scott is different than Charmin. And there's lots of advertising to differentiate your firm's products from competition. Oligopoly, a few sellers who are sensitive to each other's price, airlines, video games. So there is some price competition, but oftentimes there'll be a price leader or price follower of the competitors that are out there, who's the really big player among the three or four of us. The degree of product differentiation in oligopolies depends on the industry you're in. And advertising, there's some. The purpose is to let people know what your price point is and what your features are, but to avoid getting in a price battle with the other two or three players that are out there. Pure monopoly, one seller, they set the price for the unique product. There's no real price competition because they're the only people out there. Extended product differentiation, none, because they're the only producer of it. And extended advertising is little. The purpose might be to increase demand for the product class, or sometimes in the case of energy, to decrease demand for the product class because they don't want to create new plants. Those are expensive. So this is stuff we have to take into account as we think about our pricing as well. All right, given all these things, step two is to try to estimate the demand for our product at some price points and figure out what our revenue will be, since that's how we stay in business. So let's start with the idea of thinking about demand. Who remembers supply and demand from economics, right? Those two curves, they shift, they're tilted different ways, right? So the demand curve is a graph showing the relationship between the price of a product and the quantity that you'll sell at that price. It's going to show the maximum number of units that you can sell at a given price, given your understanding of the marketplace. And these demand curves are often used to torture you in microecon, but in business, they're also used to help you estimate product sales in competitive markets, okay? So, this demand curve, how much you can sell of a product at a particular price point is influenced by a variety of things that you immediately recall from your micro course. One thing is consumers' tastes. Are they really hot for kumquat flavored ding-dongs right now, or have they fallen out of favor, or they're interested in other things? Price and availability of similar products. I don't know if they still use this example in micro, but the old example was if the price for butter goes up too much, people just switch over to margarine or get smart or whatever. And so if there is easy ability to switch, that's going to influence the demand as well. And consumer income. So when consumers have more money, they're willing to pay more for a good. It just doesn't seem like it's as costly as it used to seem to them. So these are core factors that we need to understand. Remember all those factors outside the firm that influence us as we think about estimating our demand and our revenue. So demand factors that are those factors that determine the consumer's willingness and ability to pay for goods and services. So let's take a look at the demand curve for Red Baron Pizza. And it's going to look at the effect on annual sales of a change in price caused by movement along the demand curve. So you see our little downward pointing the right blue line is the demand curve. And we see that at $8 a pizza, we'll sell about, you can see down there, right, 2 million pizzas. And based on our research, et cetera, that's the slope of our demand curve. So we say, well, what if we could get away with selling them for $6 a piece? Is that a good idea? Well, in this case, it looks like it might be a good idea because we're now going to sell 3 million. So $8 per pizza, we sell 2 million. $6 per pizza, we sell 3 million. That's the idea of the downward sloping demand curve. Yeah? So we've moved along the demand curve for whatever reason. On the other hand, what could occur instead of moving along a demand curve is a shift in demand curve. So our blue one is the original demand curve we just looked at. Our red one is our new demand curve. And what might cause a shift in the demand curve? Suddenly, our income has gone up. Let's ignore inflation for now. We've suddenly all gotten wealthier. Minimum wage went up. Everybody's wage went up. Yay! So now what seemed expensive before doesn't seem quite as expensive right now. So here's our shift. And at $8 a pizza, now that everybody's feeling wealthy, we're now selling 4 million instead of 2 million. Why? Because it's only $8. It's no big deal. I'm feeling wealthy. So that's the difference between shifting along a demand curve and the demand curve itself shifting. How's it working for you right now? I don't know. You got to know your business. All right, total revenue is the total money that you receive from the sale of a product. And average revenue is the average amount of money that you receive for selling one unit of the product. Us normal folk would call that the price of the product, but accountants have to call it something fancy. So average revenue, the price of the product, what we get for selling one unit of the product. And marginal revenue is the change in total revenue that results from producing and marketing one more additional unit. Now, the naive student who hasn't taken micro or principles of marketing yet would say, well, wait a minute. Shouldn't I always continually want to produce and sell and market one more product? Doesn't that make sense? Wouldn't I always be making more money? And since we're bringing it up, the answer is, nuh-uh. Oh, that's odd. So let's investigate that a little bit, too. So the fundamental revenue concepts, total revenue is the total money received from the sale of a product. So logically, if total revenue is TR, price is P, and quantity sold is Q, so total revenue is P times Q. Average revenue is total revenue divided by the quantity sold, so TR divided by Q is equal to price. Hold those in mind. So here we're seeing the marginal revenue is the change in the total revenue that results from producing and selling one additional unit of a product. Marginal revenue is equal to the change in the total revenue divided by a 1 unit increase in quality, and this is also known as the slope of the total revenue curve. Notice what's going on here with our total revenue. It looks like it goes up and up and up and up for a while, and wait a minute, looks like it's beginning to go down and down a little bit. Maybe we shouldn't continually make and sell one more product. Let's see how this plays out for our friends over at Red Baron. So again, we have the downward pointing to the right demand curve. So we go from $10 a pizza to $9 a pizza. What's going to happen to our quantity sold based on our little curve? It's going to go, quantity sold, no, goes up because we're dropping price. The quantity sold goes up from 1 million to 1.5 million. And what's our total revenue going to be? Well, it turns out that our price goes from 10 to 9. So 9 times 1.5 million is $13.5 million. Okay, well, total revenue went from 10 million to 13.5. I should do that some more. Why not? So now we drop our price from down to $7. And indeed, compared to $8, our quantity goes up again to 2.5 mil. Total revenue goes up to 17.5 mil. Yay me, and you can see that's where we are on our total revenue curve over there. Wait a minute, you can see where we're headed here. We're about to get ourselves into trouble. So we're going to move down to from $6 to $5. Yes, the quantity went up from 3 million to 3.5 million. But arithmetically and on our chart, our total revenue goes down. The amount of money we're pulling in for selling and marketing one more unit of pizza is reducing our revenue. Ouch. And if we go as far as continuing the march, we get down to $4. We're now selling 4 million pizzas. Yes, we sell more pizzas. But our total revenue goes down again because we're pooling in less dollars per unit. And so our marginal revenue starts out at 6, 4, 2, minus 2, minus $4. Let's sell some more of them pizzas because we're losing $4 a piece. Let's not do that. So this is a non-obvious conclusion about how these curves work that not everybody really thinks about. Where are you on this demand curve? Should you be manufacturing, marketing one more product? So the key point, total revenues do not simply continue to grow higher and higher with each additional unit we create. As our marginal revenue drops off, the amount of money we're making for the production and sale of one more product, our total revenue drops off too. Do you think that'd be important for a business person marketer to know? Obviously. Yeah? All right, so there's our key point. To complicate our life, of course, demand isn't necessarily constant itself. We have something that you recall from micro, price elasticity of demand. This is the percentage change in quantity demanded relative to the percentage change in price. What would we like to think? Oops, we okay? People are flipping around. Is everything cool? Sometimes I was just asking, we good? Did I skip something on the notes? Okay, sometimes I goof up. I was just making sure I wasn't messing up. So what would we like to have happen? If we were to drop our price by 2%, we sure would like that to influence our demand. Lower price should mean demand should go up. And so if we're dropping it by 2%, we sure would like to see it grow by, say, more than 2%. Rather than dropping our price by 2% and having it only grow 1%, right? This is the idea of price elasticity of demand. So price elasticity of demand is the relationship of the percentage change in the quantity demanded divided by the percentage change in price. And we have an elastic demand when a 1% change in price results in a greater than 1% change in sales. So E, elasticity of demand, is greater than 1. So in this case, a slight decrease in price results in a big increase in sales because we have a relatively flat demand, that's a curve, that's an elastic demand, and a small change here in price. Look at that change in demand. That'd be sweet. Drop our price a little bit and get a lot more products sold. That's cool. I like that. Inelastic demand is when a 1% change in price results in less than a 1% change in sales. So elasticity is less than 1. So a slight decrease in price results in less than a 1% increase in sales. So our sales revenues are going to decrease. So you can see a very steep demand curve. We get a little bit of change in price, but we get an even smaller change in demand. Why did I drop the price? That wasn't a good idea. And then you just have the opposite of this to keep in mind. So when demand is inelastic, a small increase in price results in a small drop in sales for the same reason. So, well, yes. We know that the demand for cigarettes is relatively inelastic. When I raise price, sales don't drop by much. Now, of course, this is a peculiar example. What's one reason why consumers continue to buy cigarettes even though the price goes up? They're addictive, right? So it's a cheap shot at the example. So even though prices go up, sales may drop, but a little bit. It's an inelastic price. So a price increase of 10% in cigarette sales drop in the demand of cigarettes of only 4%, in part because people get addicted to cigarettes. Not such a great situation. An odd situation that has no particular meaning to us in marketing or business is unitary demand. It's the percentage change in price is the same as the percentage change in quantity. There's nothing particularly interesting about goods that are unit elastic. Rather than a distinctive category, it's really just a dividing line, a boundary between inelastic, but it has a name, and that's its name. So what causes different, other than addiction, what causes different price elasticity? Well, one question is, can you substitute anything for this thing? Anybody actually been to a movie theater recently? Yeah, what's the price of a ticket these days-ish? Do you recall? $12 to go sit with a bunch of other people in a theater that may or may not be very clean or sanitary, and yeah, watch it on a big screen. I guess you might enjoy doing that. On the other hand, what could you do to see that movie? Sit at home and stream it. And I don't know, what's it cost to rent the movie? Could be less than $12. So is there an easy substitute for the product you're selling, in which case the price goes up? Perhaps the demand is going to drop. I just do something else. Is the thing that we're talking about, in the mind of the consumer, by the way, in the mind of the consumer, is this a necessity or a luxury? If it's a necessity and the price goes up, what are they pretty much still going to have to do? Buy the product. If it's a luxury, they can probably forego it. Now, this depends a little bit on your target market. Let me see if these examples are what I think they are. Right. So for me, going out and about and renting a room at the Four Seasons Hotel, that's pretty much a luxury. So price is too high. I'm not doing that. But there might be a segment of the population that is not moving to Motel 6, right? For them, maybe that is a necessity. For me, not so much. So you have to be aware of your target audience. Right. So... Are they going to Four Seasons or Super 8? You have to understand your target audience. Also then, how expensive is this relative to their income? Is it a big cash outlay? And we already alluded to the fact that when you're feeling wealthy, it's not a big outlay. Prices go up, you're fine. You're not feeling so good, prices go up pretty soon. It's a big outlay relative to your income. You will switch. So, here's clothing and gasoline. For most people, which product category is more sensitive to price change, which is less of a necessity, more of a luxury, which is going to be more elastic?
Fashion.
Yes, fashion. Fashion is the one, for most people, maybe not for you in particular, that we will say, hey, it's too expensive. I'm backing off that. Most of us still need gas, even though prices go to $3, $4, $5 a gallon. We still need to buy it. We cut back a little bit, but perhaps not as much as we would on the equivalent change in fashion. So fashion is a more elastic price. It's more of a luxury than gasoline. It's going to be more sensitive to price changes. So let's now complicate our model, our example, for our poor folks over at Barron by looking at the price elasticity to demand and recognize that it's not fixed to make our life a little more miserable. So let's look at the decrease in price at A to B. So we're decreasing our price from $10 to $9. And it does result in an increase at this point. We go from 10 million units or $10 million in revenue to 13.5 million. So decrease in price, yay, we get an increase in revenue. So at this point, the demand for our pizza is elastic. We get a nice big jump given our relatively small change in price. But as we move along things, here we're going to make another $1 change from $6 to $5. Look what happens to our total revenue. Gosh, it goes down. So in fact, we're no longer elastic in our demand at that price point. So you have to understand, as a business person, as a marketer, the concept, and then see how it's applying at this particular price point that you're working in. So demand, the elasticity of demand changes over time. All right, so step three, now that you've understood a little bit about revenue and about demand, is to determine the cost, volume, and profit relationships. And this will emphasize for us the importance of controlling costs. We're about to talk about total cost, fixed cost, variable cost, unit variable cost, marginal cost, and marginal analysis. And here they come at us. By the way, accounting types. This is all very familiar, accounting types. No accounting types at all here? Yeah, one, a little bit. Accounting? Okay. I expect to see a lot more hands saying, yeah, I got this. All right, so how important are costs, since we're going to spend time talking about them? This was pulled from an analysis of, you guys know Shark Tank, right? Shark Tank? How important is it to the folks on Shark Tank? So, question number eight that that you need to know perfectly before you go on Shark Tank from Business Insider says, look, investors want to gauge your ability to make high profit margins by keeping your costs low or by having enough demand to keep prices high or ideally both. So if you were going to talk to the folks on Shark Tank, you should be able to explain what it costs you to make each product or service and the difference between that cost and the unit sales. By the way, have you ever watched Shark Tank and see them stumble and not be able to answer those basic questions very well? The sharks are not interested in pursuing this with you. You should also be prepared to outline your overhead costs, such as rent, utility, expenses, and insurance. And, of course, the reason that this list is listed is that not all presenters to Shark Tank know this information. Knowing your costs, your volume, and your profit is important in real business, and also if you have to be lucky enough to present to Shark Tanks. All right, so that's why we're talking about this. Total cost. Total cost is the total expense that your firm incurs by producing and marketing a product. Total cost has two main components to it. Fixed cost and variable cost. So let's think about those two things. Fixed cost is the sum of the expenses that you have that are stable and don't change with how many units you're making over a reasonable range. So regardless of whether you're making 200 units or 2,000 units, the fixed costs stay the same. What would be an example of a fixed cost, something that doesn't change, whether you're making 200 or 2,000? Yes, sir?
Rent.
rent on the offices, rent on the manufacturing plant. And that's why I say over a relevant range. If suddenly you're making $2 million, maybe you need to, rent's going to increase. But over a relevant range, whether you're making 200 units, then the cost per unit's going to be pretty high, or 2,000 units, then the cost rent per unit's going to be lower. It's the same. It doesn't change. It's a fixed cost. So there are a series of things like this that are fixed costs. Salaries for executives, you're paid, whether we could argue if this is a good deal or not, but you're paid the same whether you're selling 2,000 or 200. The rent on a building doesn't care how many units you're making, it stays the same. Basic insurance, you have to be insured regardless. These are fixed costs. They don't change as you sell more products, and certainly you need to be aware of those as you're thinking about your profitability. Their expenses. The other side of the total costs. We good? I see pens still moving. Yeah. Our variable costs. This is the total of the expenses that do vary depending on how much of a thing you're making and selling. So now let's turn the question around from fixed cost to variable cost. What would obviously have to change if you're making 2,000 units instead of 200 units? What has to change? What's a variable cost? What is it? Material. Labor. I presume you got to pay people more money to make 2,000 than 200. So these things are things you have to know about. The labor that's used to make, the materials that are used to make the product, a variable cost. What's the most expensive thing on a Tesla? The battery, dog. That is the big thing on all these electric vehicles and certainly on Teslas as well.
Take a look at any Tesla Model 3 and try to guess what's the most expensive part to manufacture. Go ahead, we'll wait. It's okay if it's not obvious, because you can't see it without tearing a Tesla apart. Investment bankers UBS ran an analysis of such a teardown and found that the battery makes up to 40% of the manufacturing costs of any Model 3. The battery has been one of Tesla's greatest challenges in their goal to make a vehicle that's affordable to most people, yet still profitable. The ticket price for a Model 3 is currently about $42,900, while the average new car in America is selling at around $32,000. In February, Mr. Musk tweeted that the Model 3 is down to just below $35,000. But only if you include $8,000 in gas savings and a tax credit that's set to expire on July 1st. The $42,900 ticket still puts the Model 3 outside of reach for most consumers.
Certainly the first or second most expensive thing in any of these vehicles is the battery pack. And so they are acutely interested in shaving off every penny they can from the cost of that pack, because obviously the vehicle market is very competitive and they are competing with internal combustion engine cars.
Analyst Sandy Munro, who tore down Model 3s, touted its battery management system, saying that Tesla is far ahead of the competition. Model 3 batteries comes in at $111 per kilowatt hour. That's 20% cheaper than the nearest competitor. But so far, it hasn't been enough to hit the $35,000 mark without tax credits. So the company has looked for other ways to optimize battery costs, like scaling production. In 2015, the automaker announced a joint venture Gigafactory with Panasonic.
Corollary is that if you centralize a huge amount of production of one thing in one location, your supply chain is simplified, your logistics are simplified, your manpower distribution is simplified. There's a lot of other overhead or exogenous things that can be, you know, significant in the overall rundown of why does this cost what it costs.
So for now, Tesla will have to find some other way to get to a true price that has wide appeal in the States. Tax credits or production line tweaks can help, but without a scientific breakthrough, there are limited ways to make big savings in the battery. For consumers, that means another generation of research is due before EVs can really compete on price with their gasoline-fueled alternatives.
what they say the cost of a Tesla 3 was when they put this together ish? Did you pay? How much? I'm just curious. It's not testable, I'm just curious. Because right now it's saying it's about 44,000. So I don't know if the cost went down or not. It said 42? All right. So it's in the domain. But I'm not sure that, although you got it, I'm not sure that everybody gets the battery is the most expensive thing. And 40% of the cost of the car, would they not like to get that battery price down? Sales commission that are paid on each unit sold. So you pay your salespeople $10 a unit sold. Makes a difference if they're selling 200 or 2,000, both to them and to your bottom line. Yeah? That's part of the marketing cost. So when we say produce and market, that's part of the marketing cost. Okay? Unit variable cost is expressed on a per unit basis. So unit variable cost is equal to the variable cost divided by the quantity manufactured. So in symbols, unit variable cost, UVC, is equal to VC, variable cost divided by Q, quantity. And marginal cost is the change in the total cost that results from producing and marketing one additional unit of a product. And you indeed want to know what happens to your cost structure if you make and market one more unit. You have to be aware of that. So the marginal cost is equal to the change in total cost divided by one unit increase in quantity. It's also known then as the slope of the total cost curve, analogous to what we just talked about on the price side. So marginal analysis is a continuing concise trade-off of incremental costs against incremental revenues. So, anybody know Beats by Dre, Dr. Dre? You know the Beats headphones? We know these? Yeah? You like them? Anybody like those? So this was, yeah, this was especially pertinent to me a while ago. My young son in New York City, blah, 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 working for a big finance firm. On the big floor that they all share, these open plans, we're looking for headphones for them. And I'm pointing out the Bose. You know Bose headphones? Those are pretty good headphones. And he says, nah, I want to look at these over here, the Beats. I said, dog, they're plastic. The sound quality isn't as good as others. He said, you look around the room, man, everybody's wearing Beats by Dre. So do anybody happen to know what they go for these days? Doesn't matter. So the question is, given what they're going to sell for, how much do they cost to make? That's what we're going to hear about right now. And we'll hear about it through one of my heroes, Rober's Morning Glory. If you don't know Rober, he's a true mook.
Doogie can swindle $1,000 from an intern, but she still can't convince him to... We're back with Rober's Morning Glory.
What were you just asking Doogie about? Something about Beats by Dre?
Yeah.
What is that?
It came out what the real cost. I'm fascinated by what something really costs.
To make?
Right, and okay. Then what they charge.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, you want the...
Give me the info. These Beats by Dre headphones, first of all, they really don't sound that great, to be honest with you.
Everybody has them. You go to the gym, you walk past a bus stop, everybody has these things on.
Yeah, they really don't sound that great. And they sell for like $300, right?
The cheapest ones you can get are $200, but they go up to $700.
$200 to $700.
Why $700? What's the difference? What could you do?
I think they have like Lil Wayne wears them. Lil Wayne. I think there's like little crystals or diamonds on them or whatever. I just seen some really fancy ones.
Ooh. Now, how much do they cost to manufacture, Dieter?
You want to guess?
$200 to $700.
All right, so give me a guess here. They're selling for $200 retail. How much do they cost to manufacture? Well, guess is no reason to know. How much? 50? 50? Higher or lower than 50? Lower, higher, lower, higher, higher. 20. All right, 50, 20. Let's see what we find out as we continue the march on the cost of the product. And he's talking here about manufacturing costs. They're going to add marketing into their discussion presently.
Yeah, and they sold the company For what?
$1 billion or something, right? Or $2 billion or
I think $3.2 billion.
$3.2 billion, okay. To Apple. Apple bought it. How much did the Beats by Dre headphones cost to manufacture?
$65.
No, get the hell out of here. No way. Not that high. No way. Not a chance. They're plastic, douche. They're plastic.
You would say how much? $65?
Yeah.
I would say they cost. Now, one thing that people don't consider, though, when you might see the cost, oh, this is what it costs to make, and look how much they charge. Well, what about all of the management, the marketing, insurance, or God knows what else, legal
fees?
That's not included in there. So that's going to bump up your actual cost per unit. But the manufacturing cost, what it costs to make these things, is probably in the range of $10 to $12.
No, I'll go down to 50. I'll give you $50. If it's 200, so it's $150 profit per one.
Jeffrey wants to pipe.
I'm going
to
put my guess at $20 from the manufacturer.
Mm-hmm. All right. Go ahead. Give me the rundown. What does it cost to manufacture Beats by Dre headphones?
So Rover was the closest. They sell for $200 to $700, like I said, but the actual cost to make, $14.
$14?
Yeah. So look at that markup.
Oh, that's incredible, isn't it?
That's why they're making so much green.
Wow.
Oh,
now,
wow.
Again, you do have to put the marketing. You think it's cheap to get LeBron James or someone to be in a commercial and to produce that commercial and to buy the airtime for that? Those don't factor into the cost. So your cost per unit may jump up to $50 or something for all we know. But the actual cost to make these things is $14? Wow.
Wow, indeed. Well, that's why the company sold for $3.2 billion, yeah? So production costs, onto which we're going to add marketing costs, admittedly. They don't tell us that. But still, that company was making some pretty good money on each one that they sold. Yes, ma'am. The only thing they provide us with is the manufacturing cost. They don't tell us about all these other costs. So it's one part of the variable cost. They don't talk about the fixed cost. And so it's just an interesting little story that we don't think about. So, no, they don't reveal the other part of it. Okay? All right. So how are we going to work with this, all this changing stuff in the real world? How are we going to figure out what's going on? Well, the way we bring it all together is through break-even analysis, a technique that analyzes the relationship between the total revenue and the total cost to figure out how much money we're going to make given various levels of production, output, sales, okay? So that's what we're talking about next, break-even analysis. So the, too fast, we good? I can't tell. All right, so the break-even point is the quantity at which the total revenue and total costs are equal. So just to state the obvious, but let me do it anyhow. If your costs equal your revenue, what's your profit? Zero. All right? They're equal. It cost you $1 million to make it and $1 million to sell it. Bringing in $1 million, you broke even. There's nothing else going on. So to figure this out, if we're going to do it in units, we can also do it in dollars. In units, we're going to divide our fixed costs, that thing that doesn't change no matter how we're making over the relevant range, by our unit price, how much we're getting to sell each one of these things, minus our unit variable cost, how much it takes to make each one of these things. So in terms of symbols, FC divided by P minus UVC. So we're going to calculate the break-even for a picture store. Again, it is fixed cost divided by our price per unit minus our unit variable cost. So in this particular case, we're going to hold the price per picture frame steady, $120. So whether we're selling, well, you can't charge $120 for zero, but whether you're selling one or 2,000 of them, your price per picture is $120, okay? Your fixed cost for Well, actually, probably for zero, I guess you could argue, is $32,000. How much is it if you're selling 2,000 of those things? How much is your fixed cost? No one knows. Oh, thank you. Thank you. $32,000. It's fixed. So whether you're going to zero or 2,000, it doesn't change. All right? So if we look at the arithmetic, our fixed costs are $32,000. Our price doesn't change. It's $120. And our unit variable cost is $40. So what is our break-even point? Just do the arithmetic there. And there's our fixed cost. There's our price, there's our unit variable cost, and the answer are $32,000 divided by $80, or 400 units to break even. Below that, you're losing money. Above that, you're making some profit. Here's McKay Bricker, but I don't know if I actually have a reason for showing her other than she does this sort of stuff. So there's McKay Bricker framing. So I guess she does that sort of stuff. So you can get frames. I don't know if they're $120 or more, but there you go. All right, so we can do this graphically. We can do it on a chart, and we're going to show you know, when the total revenue and the total costs intersect, and that point is going to identify the profit or loss for any given quantity sold. So we're just taking the numbers we saw and putting them into a chart for the visual learners among us. So what would that solid black line going along that doesn't change be? That would be the fixed cost at $32,000. Okay? So that's easy enough to picture. Then we can look at our variable costs. And we know that our variable costs are going to increase based on how many of these things we're making. So we just plot that out. The variable cost is equal to the total cost is the purple line. It's equal to the variable cost plus the fixed cost. And so it goes up over time. And over the relevant range for us, total revenue, fortunately, also goes up over the range we're talking about. So let's add into the baseline the idea of these costs. And so here we have the two crossing over, total revenue crossing over total costs. We get the break-even point. And to the left of that, I already revealed it, you got a loss. You're losing money, dog. Be nice to know where that point is. And of course, to the right of it, the beautiful territory of profitability. All right? So we might think about an example where we go to 1,000 frames. How are we doing at 1,000 frames? Well, 1,000 frames, our fixed cost is still $32,000. Doesn't change. Variable costs are $40,000, so now we're on the bottom of the line there. So our total cost is $72,000. Our revenue, since we're selling $120 per picture, at 1,000 is $120,000. And la-di-da, our profit is $48,000 at 1,000 units. Hoo-yah, we've done good. All right, so that's just the example of a break-even analysis. From the book, same thing. I just walked you through it. Okay, that's the end of the material for Chapter 13. And even though there's still, I'd say, 6 minutes left, I'm going to give you some extra time to study for the midterm, which opens on Saturday. Go forth and prosper. See you next time. Don't forget the midterm.